Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. The charmingly, I hope, standard two guests today, each looking at a large, important Latin American country. Forrest Hilton will talk about the massive fires burning across Brazil, a joint product of climate change and economically motivated arson, and Edward Ackerman will evaluate the achievements of Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador, AMLO, as he hands power over to his successor, Claudia Sheinbaum, after having just engineered a controversial reworking of the country's judiciary. Brazil is on fire, and it's not exactly clear why. It looks to be a mix of climate change and economically motivated arson committed by gangsters in the pay of capitalists. Because of drought, the conflagrations have spread like, yes, wildfire. The smoke from the fires is drifting across the northern part of the continent, causing mass respiratory distress. Particularly at risk, Brazil's indigenous population, much of which lives on land that mining and ranching interests want very badly. Meanwhile, the government of Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva is incapable of dealing with the crisis. My first guest, Forrest Hilton, has a piece on the topic on the London Review of Books website that's worth checking out. But here he is to tell the story in person. Forrest is a visiting professor of history at the Graduate School of the Federal University of Bahia, Brazil. A quick fill-in on some historical points. Lula, leader of the Workers' Party, known by its Portuguese initials PT, was president of Brazil from 2003 to 2010. He was succeeded by a protege, Dilma Rousseff, who was impeached in what was effectively a legislative coup led by right-wing forces in 2016. She was succeeded by her right-wing vice president, who served through 2018, when he was succeeded by the further-right demagogue Jair Bolsonaro. In 2017, Lula was charged and convicted on corruption charges in a trumped-up, politically motivated campaign, and spent a year and a half in prison before being released and ultimately exonerated. Lula returned to the presidency in January 2023. The coup, the jailing, and the rise of a fascist right under Bolsonaro took all the wind out of his sails. The once ambitious and fairly successful social democratic agenda of his first term is barely visible in the second. Here's Forrest Hilton with more. There are a lot of wildfires in the Amazon basin. As far as I know, that's not being covered here very well. So what's going on? Give us the update.
In terms of making sense of the large picture, it's very chaotic. And the federal government response has been anemic at best. So we don't really fully understand everything that's going on that would explain why the country is on fire to the degree that it is. And if you look at the map right now, you'll see that the neighboring countries of Uruguay, Paraguay, Argentina, Peru, and Bolivia, especially Bolivia, have been directly affected by the smoke from these fires. And in the kind of political, economic, and demographic part of the country, which is Sao Paulo city and state, half of the people are reporting respiratory problems. And if you widen that scope to include Rio de Janeiro and then Belo Horizonte in Minas Gerais, you really have the urban centers, the major urban centers, and it's about 40% of people who have respiratory problems from this. So this is a major story because it's international and it's what climate change looks like in real time. And of course, it's inseparable from the political economic model that's being pursued, particularly in the countryside. But you can't really divorce the crimes that are being committed in the countryside from high finance in Sao Paulo. It's not as if there are some nasty landlords and then if only you could get them under control. That's not the case at all, because high finance is really in charge.
Could you elaborate on that? What's the local stuff that's going on, and how is high finance behind it?
So in terms of the fires, we know in Sao Paulo, based on the study of one climate scientist, that within a 90-minute period on the day of August 28th, close to 2,000 fires were set. So obviously, that's a pretty coordinated action. And really only organized crime can carry it out. So the leading organized crime group in Sao Paulo is the Primeiro Comando do Capital, the PCC. So they seem to be behind it in Sao Paulo to a large degree. Why? it's not easy to say because the PCC was against Bolsonaro, and the PCC, you know, presumably is trying to make politicians maybe in the state of Sao Paulo look bad or acting on the interests of someone else that's essentially paying them to carry out these actions. We really don't know. But even if you could solve the riddle of Sao Paulo, where there appears to be a very sort of coordinated campaign that amounts to a criminal conspiracy, it's hard to see whether that's the case or to what extent that's the case in the rest of Brazil, because the fires are raging all through the Amazon. They're raging through the center west, which has this gigantic swamp region, and that is on fire. You'd have to look region by region to see exactly what's going on. I think the fire started about 4 or 5 weeks ago, and as with the floods that left Rio Grande do Sul in the south underwater and its capital, Porto Alegre, destroyed, it sort of boggles the mind, the scale of the catastrophe environmentally, the failure of a concerted, coordinated government response, no preparation, and certainly no reaction after the fact. So far, nothing has ever happened on this scale before, both with the flooding in the south and now the fires, which stretch throughout much of the northeast, almost the entirety of the north, the center west. The far south is, I believe, still getting too much rain. Parts of Rio Grande do Sul are newly underwater again. So climate disaster has hit Brazil on the biggest scale imaginable. And it's not entirely clear, as I said, how to explain the fact that it is close to nationwide. And there's more than just a criminal conspiracy going on, obviously. Indigenous peoples throughout Brazil have stated that these fires are a direct threat to their ability to stay on land that mining companies in particular would like to have a crack at. They're legally prohibited from doing so, but, you know, they do it by hook or by crook. And so burning the land that indigenous peoples inhabit would presumably make it easier to move in with the mining equipment.
I would suggest a motive here. I'd assume organized crime would not be doing this on its own initiative. Somebody paid them to do this. So that would be the why?
That would be my guess. I mean, all we can do is speculate. My sense of why organized crime would do something on that scale and in such a coordinated fashion, I would assume that something bigger has to be behind that. And if you were looking to set fire in Sao Paulo to the whole state, that would be the outfit that you would want to hire to do it. That remains murky, but the mining companies would certainly like their prerogatives of capital accumulation to be unimpeded by existing Brazilian law on indigenous people's rights and territory. So the mining companies have a strong motive. Ranchers, presumably, because it's pretty easy for ranchers to move in on land that's been burnt when there aren't any people living there and then say it's theirs. So there's also a motive when it comes to ranchers. But what I was saying previously about landlords is that a lot of what they do is on credit, and a lot of times they're in debt, and it's the banks ultimately that are financing a lot of the roughest forms of violence and dispossession on the ground in order to make these lands available for mining, for ranching. The latest thing is carbon capture. But obviously you can't do that if the forests are burning down. But it would seem that mostly ranching and mining interests, which are extremely powerful in Brazil, whether it's cattle, I think Brazil exports more beef than any country in the world, and cattle have in large measure taken over the countryside. Cattle ranching is a pretty entrenched and powerful interest. And as I mentioned, a lot of cattle ranchers are pretty heavily indebted to whatever bank it may be. As you might imagine, politicians, particularly right-wing politicians, are pretty closely linked to those ranching and mining interests, particularly in specific territories where there's just an abundance of riches. And those are territories like Bahia and like Amazonas, which have pretty considerable indigenous populations. Brazil's indigenous population is maybe 1,800,000. The exact figure escapes me, but it's a relatively small number given how large Brazil is. And yet the amount of wealth that dominant interests and the Brazilian government, even under Lula, they're fighting deforestation, to be sure, but at the same time, the kind of criminal elements in the countryside that are going to try to get indigenous lands by hook or by crook, and the same goes for communities composed of descendants of escaped slaves called comunidades quilombolas, and they find themselves in a similar situation. The government of Lula has been very ineffective, in fact, completely ineffective, at halting the encroachment of these people onto indigenous lands. And there was one extremely scandalous case, the case of the Yanomami, who live up near the Venezuelan border in the state, I believe, of Roraima, the capital of which is Boa Vista, which is a kind of gold mining boom town. And Lula made a very big show of saying, we are going to shut down illegal gold mining. You know, we're going to send in the federal police and we're going to crack down on this. But they really haven't been able successfully to get the miners out of indigenous Yanomami territory. And those interests, mining and ranching, continue to advance there. So even when the government decides that it's actually going to make a specific campaign to target a specific practice on indigenous lands, their success is mixed at best. And for the most part, you know, they're not trying to do that. I think the Yanomami would be the exception rather than the rule.
So what is it, a lack of political will? Are they outgunned, outmanned? What's the situation?
A lot of it has to do with evolution of the PT and its ability to represent popular movements and organizations. And it also has to do with the composition of Brazil's Congress. So they have an enormous number of political parties which have very little in the way of ideology and program, and a lot in the way of how are we going to divide up the government pork. Brazil's system, according to the 88 Constitution, to some degree the president is really subject to congressional whims and dictates in a way that is different from the United States. It's impossible, really, for Lula to get any traction with progressive initiatives in Congress, and the PT delegation in Congress really represents the PT's interests as a political party, and it's much more a party of professional politicians at various levels, precisely because the trade union movement that the Workers' Party, the PT, grew out of was hit with massive waves of deindustrialization in the 1990s and ever since 2000. So that the industrial working class that was the base of the PT and that explained its rise in the 1980s began not to disappear, but to remain as a remnant minority. A new working class produced by neoliberalism arose, and that's the majority of the Brazilian working class today. And except for specific government assistance programs, the Brazilian government and the PT, they don't really have much in the way of inroads. And that explains why when you go to the kind of outskirts of any big city, it's the Pentecostal churches and the drug gangs that are in charge of those zones. These are vast areas throughout Brazil's cities.
I'm speaking with the historian Forrest Hilton. You say in the London Review of Books piece, this is developmentalism in its senescence. The contradictions between business and usual, with interest rates sky high and the far right in the march, despite Bolsonaro's fall from grace, now, it amounts to a Brazilian version of the U.S. Democratic Party under Lula, with empty spectacles of celebration, cannot hold. The wall of contention is too thin. Could you expand on that?
I also mentioned that there was a ceremony to return this priceless artifact to the Tupinambá people that had been taken by Denmark at some point or landed in Denmark in the late 17th century. And so Lula made a big show of this celebration, and here we are with indigenous peoples, and he has an indigenous woman activist, Sonia Guajajara, in charge of the Ministry of Indigenous Affairs. But his government has completely sidelined her, marginalized her, and, you know, she's called in sometimes essentially for what amount to photo ops. And at this event, which was supposed to be the equivalent of a photo op, a Tupinambá leader read Lula the Riot Act about his utter either inability or unwillingness. And that's what she was essentially saying. Like, it seems to us to be a lack of political will, but maybe it's just political weakness beyond will. But that kind of thing is very uncommon because the PT is able to control the progressive media, I would say, pretty tightly, and certainly the artistic and cultural sphere. And it's understandable why when you have the far right on the march. And the effort to storm the government installations on the 8th of January, 2023, to repeat the kind of Trump spectacle in Washington, to repeat that in Brazil, is what Jair Bolsonaro did in order to show that really he's the head of the fascist masses and that he can do these kinds of things and get away with it. Right now, the government seems to be negotiating amnesty for the people that were involved in that because it was the military that was behind this. And there were all these encampments outside of military barracks. Now, Brazil was ruled by the military from 1964 until I think it was 85. So it's familiar with military dictatorship. It has a deep tradition of authoritarianism. The military police were never reformed. And it's a question, an open question, who actually controls the police forces in Brazil. But the military was behind that uprising on the 8th of January. And the people who were camping out in front of the military barracks were relatives and friends of the military. If a left-wing party movement group were to try to hold an encampment outside of military barracks, they would be dispatched within an hour, 2 hours at most. And these people were there for days on end, and there was military people fraternizing with them. The extent to which the military wanted a show of fascist force by taking over government installations and destroying them in order, I guess, to show Lula that they can do that and get away with it. And that appears to be what is going to happen. It appears they are going to get away with it. Bolsonaro, if he ends up in jail, it's probably going to be for other lesser charges like jewel theft, stuff he received from Saudi Arabia and then wanted to sell in the United States and stuff. That to some degree is like getting Al Capone on tax evasion charges. I suppose whatever it takes, but the problem is defeating Bolsonaro juridically, that's possible. It's possible to imagine him in jail. But the PT has done nothing to defeat Bolsonaro or Bolsonarismo politically. And that's why I say it's clearly still on the march. It's going to be back in 2026. I'm not sure who the candidate would be, but possibly the governor of Sao Paulo, Tarcísio Freitas. He's positioning himself as someone who would like to be the next Bolsonaro. But when I say the wall of contention is too thin, these interest rates have been sky high. And at no point has Lula kind of sat down with the head of the central bank and said, listen, this is crippling everything that we would like to do. And we've got to find some kind of solution. We can't allow interest rates to stay sky high. And that just hasn't been the case at all. So I suppose one of the lessons maybe learned from the coup against Dilma and the fact that Lula was made a political prisoner was if you dare challenge the prerogatives of agro-industry, agribusiness, and high finance, we will overthrow you in a second. That may well have worked in terms of inducing a sort of excess of conciliatory caution with the ruling interests of the country, whereby it seems impossible to do anything progressive in healthcare, to do anything progressive in education, and it's all about balanced budgets. That's why I said, you know, this is developmentalism in its essence. The country's burning down, and another part of it's underwater. And there's a Supreme Court justice who said, okay, what we need to do is authorize emergency credits. And the Development of Planning and Budget, the Office of Planning and Budget, says, no, we're aiming for a balanced budget here, and that would upset it. That, to me, seems that's a sign of dementia or senescence in terms of what is the model of accumulation that Brazil currently has and what are the results as we speak. And that's why Lula can go to the UN and appear to be a progressive leader of the global south. But the fact is, Brazil's burning here, and there's almost nothing being done by government authorities, nothing effective to protect indigenous peoples, just as there was very little effective done. In fact, Bolsonaro's government didn't want to protect indigenous peoples during the pandemic. And he has a long personal history when it comes to investment interests in Yanomami territory relating to gold, but this was for indigenous peoples in Brazil generally. So between the pandemic and then the fires, these are potentially cataclysmic in the case of the fighters.
What's going on within the PT? Are they so just paralyzed by fear of the right? Or is there some internal issue that's paralyzing them? What's going on?
The PT proved totally unable to really mobilize any kind of opposition the whole time that Bolsonaro was in power and during the time that Lula was in jail. And even once he got out of jail, they were able to get people out to campaign rallies. And campaign rallies in Brazil are also parties and concerts. And, who wouldn't want to go to one? That's essentially the superficial approach. It has nothing to do with actually building constituencies or maintaining constituencies. And certainly in Bahia, it's all about taking the PT vote for granted. You know, they know that Bahia is their stronghold, that no one's going to vote for Bolsonaro. You know, you put on a good show, and you can put just about anybody in office in governor. And they put this guy in who's just a complete placeholder for the PT. So everybody knows, even if it's untrue, what the far right says about Lula being personally corrupt and the PT is like full of all these corrupt people, right? That sort of conspiratorial right-wing view of the left as the real corruption, whereas they're somehow, I'm not sure what, they're above the law, I suppose. But they see the PT as completely corrupt. And many people who are not sympathetic to Bolsonaro and not sympathetic to the right are skeptical of what the PT is actually accomplishing with public resources. Where are the results? And, you know, they can point to, I think, a significant reduction in extreme poverty. I think the PT in so far has done on hunger. They've made some progress compared to where things were when Bolsonaro left office. And they clearly have made progress on halting deforestation. But as I said, the PT doesn't really have a kind of social movement or trade union constituency anymore. The idea of transformismo, right, from Antonio Gramsci, and also there was a passive revolution where many demands of trade unions and social movements were partially incorporated into the initial Lula governments. But then, subsequently, Lula and Dilma did make all sorts of deals with the devil, and Lula is still making all sorts of deals with the devil. And in the case of Dilma, obviously it came back to haunt her because capital decided that they'd had enough of social programs, of any kind of upward mobility. They didn't like the democratization of higher education, and there was no reason for them to continue on with the PT because the PT had begun to implement a range of neoliberal austerity measures already. So there's a sense in which a lot of people are wary and skeptical of what the PT is doing in power. And certainly the guy who's the governor of Bahia, Rui Costa, he was governor here for, I think, at least 8 years. And he was pretty closely allied with some of the more repressive wings of the police outfits in Bahia, and the violence of police repression under his governorship was incredibly high. And police kill more people in Bahia, more young men mostly, they're almost all young men, than in all of the United States.
God.
This happens on the PT's watch.
You say in the piece, a new leader of the far right, Pablo Marçal, how do you pronounce that?
Marçal, yeah.
Yeah, compares himself to Trump. What's his story?
Well, he's new. He's like this like fake like coach, you know, like one of these life coach guru types, but it's all like fake and fraudulent and involves like embezzlement and stuff. Like a lot of these new Brazilian influencers, he's up to his neck in financial crimes. And after he got hit over the head with a chair on TV by a political candidate who's also himself a television talk show host, the guy has plummeted in the polls. And it's hard to say if he's just a flash in the pan in this electoral campaign or if, you know, he'll have some kind of future. But the governor of Sao Paulo, Tarcísio Freitas, he is an equally far-right figure, and I would think his relationships with the kind of business and high finance community in Sao Paulo would be excellent, and that he would be the person poised to replace Bolsonaro, who's been banned from politics for like 10 years and is probably going to jail at some point.
I was Forrest Hilton, visiting professor of history at the Graduate School of the Federal University of Bahia, Brazil. and a frequent contributor on South American affairs to the London Review of Books. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after musical break. Some of Laurie Anderson's classic, O Superman, remixed by Lauren Flax. Next, a more cheerful story in Brazil's Mexico, where Andrés Manuel López Obrador, known as AMLO, is about to hand power over to his successor, Claudia Sheinbaum, after having just engineered a controversial overhaul of the country's judiciary. Judgeships that were once filled by appointment are now going to be filled by elections. High-minded liberals are in a high dudgeon over this. Here to evaluate AMLO's time in office, the prospects for his successor, and the judicial reform is Edwin Ackerman, Associate Professor of Sociology at Syracuse University. Claudia Sheinbaum is taking office in just a few days, so maybe let's do some scene setting. I want to talk about the judicial reform in detail, but let's do some more general scene setting first. Here's a lead from a Bloomberg story a couple of days ago. President Andrés Manuel López Obrador is leaving his successor a volatile currency, tepid economic growth, and the widest budget deficit since the 1980s. But the most urgent challenge Claudia Sheinbaum will face is calming investor fears over the outgoing leader's overhaul of the judiciary. Now, I'm not sure I'd rank investor fears very high on my list of priorities, but he's also leaving as a very popular figure. So could you fact-check that Bloomberg lead before we talk about the judicial reform?
Yeah, exactly. So he's leaving with very high approval ratings, getting close to 80%, depending on the pollster, but really averaging around 70%. And so is Claudia Sheinbaum, coming in with similar approval numbers. The party they represent, Morena, currently holds a two-thirds majority in the legislature, in Congress, and is one short of doing so in the Senate, although they've already been able to pass things negotiated to get that vote or to have somebody abstain from showing up in critical moments. So meaning, in essence, that in practice they have a two-thirds majority in Congress and Senate. They also hold the vast majority of state legislatures and state governorships. In many places down the ballot, the party that has won all the positions. So politically speaking, Claudia Sheinbaum starts with a very, very strong foot forward. The opposition, on the other hand, is still in shambles. It went as a coalition of parties that had up to a few years ago been sort of historic enemies. They figured out during the past 6 years that their only chance of remaining competitive was to link up and produce a coalition. The results of the past election were really poor. They even lost ground compared to 2018, to the previous presidential election. And of course, internal tensions within that coalition have flourished because it is a losing coalition. So the existing power battles within it have just intensified. So they're not in a really good spot. Also, I think at the economic level, there are several things that seem better on the horizon than a few years ago. First of all, while you don't have pandemic depression, the inflation, which has been a problem in the past years, as it has been across the globe, is slowly being subdued. And in terms of finances, of budget, of governmental budget, there's a bit of a more nuanced discussion that has to be had, because part of what's happened is that the outgoing administration has decided to leave all the major public works projects paid for. And that's what creates this budget imbalance. But the argument of the government is that this is a temporary imbalance of a year or two, really, that has to do with having paid off everything before leaving. Then the currency, that part is probably the part that's wrongest about that lead. One of the stories of the past years has been the super peso, no, the appreciation power of the peso over the years after decades of depreciation. It is true that in the past months, there's been a little bit of volatility that has to do with, one, the usual volatility around the transfer of power, particularly, you know, in a situation of heightened political tension. I hesitate to say polarization because the actual population is overwhelmingly in support of the government, but it is true that at the level of political discourse by you know, political professionals, including politicians and op-ed writers and so forth, it is a particularly tense moment. So there's volatility surrounding that, and then volatility, yes, surrounding the judicial reform, which we'll talk about in a bit, and a series of other reforms that will likely be happening in the next few months, precisely taking advantage of this two-thirds majority that they've achieved.
If foreign investors were happy, I might be a little worried that AMLO wasn't doing the right thing. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, one thing that's always interesting or sort of, you know, tricky about this is that there are layers, I think, really high layers of investors that are fine with things. They're big enough that they can adapt to different domestic political circumstances. They have a lot of margin. The real anti-Obrador or anti-Morena business sector is a more middle to high level domestic capital that is really actively organizing and sort of hysterically fighting against some of these policies. But for better or worse, perhaps high capital, I think, has figured out that it's actually fine. It's going to do fine.
And of course, one of the reasons he's leaving so popular and the party is doing so well and his successor did so well in the election is that he delivered a lot of better material benefits to the Mexican population. that's a great economic success story, really.
That's increasingly one of the least controversial points here, that, you know, you look at official figures, the real wages over the past 6 years surged by almost 30%. Labor's share of income increased by 8 percentage points, which is by far the most significant rise after, as you can imagine, a prolonged period of stagnation of that balance between labor share of income and capital share of income. Yeah, you can go down the list. The earnings of the bottom 10% of income earners soared by almost 100%. You have slight declines in the Gini coefficient, decline in overall poverty levels. At least 5 million people lifted out of poverty in the past 6 years. And so this is not only the largest reduction in the 21st century in the country, but also happening in the midst of pandemic, recession, and then global inflation. The accomplishments on that front, I think, are increasingly undisputable.
Okay, in that same Bloomberg story, a fellow named Amrit Singh, director of the Rule of Law Impact Lab at the Stanford Law School, of course, somebody at Stanford Law School does not like the judicial reforms. But he says the president-elect will have trouble convincing Mexicans that she genuinely intends to place their interests above political calculations that require her to continue AMLO's legacy. I mean, that seems like a concocted critique, but what do you think of that?
That line of argumentation has to assume, for reasons that they never fully make clear, that Claudia Sheinbaum has to break with AMLO, which is just sort of senseless in principle, but also just contextually, if you follow her history, she is formed politically under Obrador's movement. Well, her first big position in government as Minister of the Environment is in Obrador's city mayorship, Mexico City mayorship in the early 2000s. She was a very important leader in the protest movements that existed after the 2006 elections, central figure in the foundation of the party of Morena. That is her political training. There's no reason why you would expect a break whatsoever. I think she agrees with AMLO on most things. There are some issues, I think, that she has slightly different views in terms of priorities, and we'll have to, I think, do the work of synthesizing her priorities to the legacy of Obradorismo. But in general, there's an overlap ideologically. So I don't think there's any need or any real attempt from her or her camp to create some sort of distance. In fact, I mean, the whole campaign was on how much of a continuation it'll be. The, you know, some of the slogans of the campaign were, this is, we're building the second floor of the transformation. You know, it's about continuity. So that's her pitch. So in any case, if the idea is that in order to retain the trust of the majority of Mexican voters, she would actually have to continue with what she said in the campaign, which was continuity as opposed to breaking with. Breaking with AMLO would actually make her lose the trust of the majority.
It's hard to see why you should break for something that was quite successful.
Right, right.
There is, if you want to be superstitious about it, the successor curse, you know, Dilma versus Lula and Maduro versus Chavez.
And there's several examples,
You mentioned that she has some different priorities. What are those? What might that look like?
So one, for example, is the question of how to think about and how to draw policy around climate change. For AMLO, even though he was never a climate change skeptic or anything close to any of that, in any case, he would speak of himself as some sort of pro-environmentalist politician in superficial and almost outdated level, where environmentalism for him is equated to planting millions of trees, that sort of thing. But he had more difficult time dealing with the question of climate change as it related to the persistence of Pemex, the state-owned oil company. The state-owned oil company is historically an important identity element of the country's left. You know, it was nationalized in the 1930s by a leftist president, Lázaro Cárdenas. And for most of the 20th century and into the 21st century, it has served, again, symbolically even, as an identifying element of what the left is about in Mexico, the preservation, the continuation of the state character of the energy sector. And AMLO, for decades, had been critical of the way that Pemex had been privatized, left to become unproductive and burdened with debt. Neoliberal governments would just transfer debt to it. Part of the historic program of Obradorismo was the rescuing of the state-owned oil company. So they finally make it to power in 2018, and it turns out that there's a climate crisis. Fossil fuels seem to be the problem. For him, energy sovereignty, as he puts it, or again, the state character of the oil company, trumped the concerns around the use of fossil fuels. It even produced, during his time period, a very interesting political schism with the passage of a new electricity law that would revamp the state's capacity to produce electricity. You had a bunch of private electricity companies, mostly American, that claim that new law that gave state-produced electricity an official preponderance in the market, that violated NAFTA. But the argument was that it violated environmental clause in NAFTA agreements. You had, on the one hand, green capital, they claimed to be producing electricity in a cleaner way, pitted against state-owned fossil fuel companies. Enter Claudia Sheinbaum. Sheinbaum was Secretary of the Environment in the start of her political career. She was an academic until fairly recently, devoted to questions of energy and climate change. So that is a moment where Sheinbaum will have to synthesize what she thinks, the way she presents the issues, and the legacy of Obradorismo. And again, the emphasis to me is synthesize, because it's also just politically pragmatically speaking, not a good idea to break with AMLO because of its popularity and the sort of automatic legitimacy, in a sense, that her government has as being the hero of AMLO's government. But she will have to synthesize this. And, you know, to the extent that I've seen her get asked about this, she says something along the lines of, we need to keep using state-owned fossil fuels to be able to finance the transition to cleaner energy. Still trying to milk Pemex, but the objective now is to use those funds to secure a transition.
I'm speaking with the sociologist Edwin Ackerman. So let's talk some about the judicial reforms. I saw a U.S. government, I can't remember who it was, but somebody from the State Department or something, saying the judicial reforms threaten Mexico's democratic nature, which is really rich coming from an American an American official. But still, I mean, that's the common complaint. It's a power grab. It's going to lead to corruption, dictatorship, and all kinds of terrible, terrible things. So let's set the scene first. Just going into these reforms, what was the judicial system like? How are judges selected? And how do they perform?
Before this reform, the judges were appointed, including the Supreme Court judges, in a method not unlike that of the U.S., where the executive proposes, in the case of Mexico, proposed a set of three candidates from which the legislature would then have to debate and choose. If a certain percentage of support within the legislature wasn't secured, then the decision would fall back on the executive to handpick one of those three candidates that was suggested. One thing to keep in mind is that the Supreme Court in Mexico is already term limited to 15 years, so it's not a lifetime appointment. Then down the line, you would have, depending on the levels, you would have either more direct appointments by the executive. Let me just focus here on mostly on the Supreme Court, because just to mention briefly, what the judicial reform is that just got passed a couple of weeks ago is that it opens up those positions for elections. These are elected judges all the way up to the Supreme Court judges. So that's the part that's really the most controversial part of the reform.
Does the Supreme Court have the power to overturn laws like ours can?
It has the power to determine that something is unconstitutional, and therefore it can overturn laws, exactly. The new reform would have Supreme Court judges be elected through a popular vote to term limit positions of ranging 8 to 15 years, depending actually on the percentage of votes that they got. To understand this, we need to introduce several elements here to the context. Right? One is that there's been this brewing tension in the past 6 years during AMLO's presidency between the Supreme Court and the executive and the legislature for that matter. In a more substantial way, this has manifested in things like the Supreme Court blocking major reforms that had managed to secure 2/3 majorities in Congress and Senate, constitutional reforms on things like, for example, energy sovereignty, and dismissing this on, frankly, petty proceduralist grounds, throwing out this huge legislative efforts in a whiff. Right? There's several examples of that. But then there were red flags raised about an increasing politicization, not in the ideological sense purely, but in the actual sense of organic connections between Supreme Court justices and political formations that are opposed to Morena. So, for example, at the beginning of the year, there was a scandalous revelation that the head of the Supreme Court had been holding secret meetings with the leader of the PRI and a very high-ranking leader of the PAN, of the neoliberal bloc, behind the scenes, essentially. And it's still unclear what the meetings were about. You have, from the very beginning of the presidency, a clash over salaries, over compensation of the Supreme Court justices. When AMLO took power, he voluntarily lowered his salary. The Constitution says that no public official can earn more than the president. So that by default meant that all the high-ranking bureaucracy had to also abide constitutionally to a salary decrease. The Supreme Court, in violation of the Constitution, has refused to accept that cut. And let me just mention a couple more because, I mean, the list is long, one, I think, that is really revealing is that by the judiciary's own report, at least half of the employees of the judiciary have family members working in the judiciary. And this percentage increases even more so with judges and justices. So this is over half of the employees there. And this is not counting retired justices. You have quite literally a network, a semi-formal network of influence. You know, can also see, for example, the lack of accountability in the fact that throughout the whole 21st century, there's not a single judge that has ever been prosecuted, right, despite as you might imagine, being there being glaring cases of, you know, misconduct and illegal activity and so forth. So in short, corrupt and sort of rotten entity.
This is all happening very quickly, right? This new system can be in place in less than a year.
Yeah, in 2025, it's going to be broken up in two parts, but the election of the Supreme Court justices is in 2025. And then there's a second batch of elections in 2027.
The standard establishment criticism of this is that it's going to politicize, which is funny in the light of what you said about how politicized it was already. But this is the establishment critique, that it's going to politicize the judiciary. It's not going to be high-minded and independent anymore. It's going to be base, having to, on the one hand, yield to the executive branch, legislative branch, but also, you know, having to pander to the public in order to get votes. And that might not be best for their performance. So what do you say to those criticisms?
So the first thing is to keep in mind that ironically, you know, the argument that both, let's say both parties are making is based supposedly on the same principle. So the argument that AMLO and his supporters present is we need to establish judicial independence, right? From private interest groups, we have a judiciary that is in fact politicized, too beholden to semi-formal networks of influence and so forth. And that the way around it, or at least a way around it, is to open it up to elections. And here, I mean, a quick thing to say, which is often perplexing to me when I read some of the critiques coming from the American liberal press, is that, you know, they're coming from a country in which judges are elected. And the Supreme Court justices of at least half of the states in the U.S. are elected. There's that concrete case that somehow is forgotten. Of course, there's problems associated with electing of judges in the U.S., you know, the problem of low turnout or low information, voters, etc. But none of those are discussed as examples of democratic backsliding, right, which is what's the framework used to talk about this in Mexico. The critiques then are, I think, several-fold. I mean, there's some, I think, that have more merit. I think one of the critiques that has bit more merit, in my opinion, is that this overhaul is way too disruptive in relation to the actual problems that it might be able to solve. I think there's some truth to that, but all that points to is the fact that this in and of itself is not going to be the end-all fix of these things, but it doesn't really seem like an argument against it. The second argument that I think is quite pervasive is what you were pointing to, the idea that this is a way for the judiciary to be captured essentially by party loyalists. There's a couple of things to say there, right? The first one is that, ironically, the system in place before the reform was a much easier way of doing that, right? So just think about the way that the Supreme Court justices are appointed. They are appointed, as I was saying in the beginning, before this reform, by the executive with the ratification by the legislature. Right now, the executive and 2/3 of Congress and Senate are held by Morena. So if they wanted to focus on putting in party loyalists, it seems like the existing rules would have been an easier way to do that. You have to remember, too, that there's already time limits on the Supreme Court justices. So it's not that the justices that are there are going to be there by existing rules. They were going to be there for the rest of their life. There is, of course, some truth to the idea that the likelihood is that the judges that will be elected will be, I wouldn't call them party loyalists, mainly actually because party identification in the country isn't anywhere as deep as it is, let's say, in the U.S. But they will be likely, I think, ideologically aligned. And this will be a reflection simply of the preferences of the electorate. There will be subsequent elections of Supreme Court justices in which it might be that the preferences of the electorate have changed. I mean, this is the obvious mechanics of democracies. Yes, it is true that the likelihood is that the judges elected in 2025 will be ideologically aligned, but there's no theoretical reason why that always has to be the case. There's nothing, you know, in the institutions or in the law that passed that says that the opposition can't win eventually. And then if I can say just one final critique that gets launched a lot is the idea that it's linked to this previous one, but the idea is that it's going to eliminate the autonomy of the judiciary, so the different separation of power, right, by making it respond more directly to popular will. And that critique starts to become very highbrow, sort of political theory about the separation of powers. In some strict sense, actually, and this applies, I think, to any liberal democracy, there is no separation that's possible between powers, right? So if you're talking about, let's say, a Supreme Court that's not elected but appointed by a mix of the legislature and the executive, well, those themselves are representative of popular will. So you're talking about a separation of steps by which the popular will is reflected, but you don't really have a full separation. And in fact, a full separation of powers would imply some sort of creation of a separate caste, almost sort of shielded from democratic pressures, which in turn would be anti-democratic. So there is no strict separation ever really possible. At the end, to me, what this boils down to, this sort of highbrow discussions of political theory, of political philosophy, I mean, you boil it down, I think what they're worried about is that they calculated that their preferred political option is going to lose. And if that calculation was different, they wouldn't be worried about digging up conceptual debates and so forth.
Has the Mexican judiciary been, like it has been in the U.S., a force of reaction against any kind of progressive legislation?
Yes, it has, very much so. So one is corruption in the sense of, you know, being, again, beholden by, let's say, drug trafficker money, etc., right? But ideologically as well, bias towards the right. And in the past years, again, the Supreme Court in particular has brought down this huge legislative efforts, right, that you know, required securing two-thirds majorities when Morena did not have, in fact, two-thirds majority. That meant a long process of negotiation in order to pass this big progressive constitutional reforms that were then blocked by the Supreme Court, again, on very petty proceduralist grounds. So there is this political bias there, for sure.
That was Edwin Ackerman, Associate Professor of Sociology at Syracuse University. His article on the AMLO phenomenon is on Jacobin's website. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go at this, some of Misconception by Return Fall, remixed with some preaching by the always amusing KPFA alum Ellen Watts, by Charlotte DeWitt. Till next week, bye.
When a society allows a certain number of people to withdraw, it should have no anxiety that everybody will want to withdraw. Because some people are absolutely fascinated in competition, in being involved, in playing the game. They should be. It's fine for them. Because we haven't provided for it. A society which is insane and unsure of itself cannot allow that to happen. It says everybody must join. Everybody must work.